This is an ABC podcast.
When 80-year-olds are out climbing mountains to help protect the pygmy possum, you can bet it's a cute little creature, and that you might feel, well, a little less active than her. I'm Amanda Vanstone. This is Counterpoint, the program with different views from here and around the world. The world has a lot of ocean space and it needs protecting. Are China and Russia holding out in a few points relating to disputed territories because of the South China Sea? And what impact would there be if the Chinese view held sway? What holds a bit of sway in the media is an almost vacuous, continual bagging of colonialism, and particularly British colonialism. But they were latecomers to the field, and like other colonial powers, brought both good and bad. You know what they say, the truth and the whole truth. And what is the truth about irritation? You're not happy, yes, but you're not angry either. It's a state where we are often in, but to which academia pays little attention. But first, let's go to protecting the oceans. You may or may not have seen some publicity, there was quite a bit, about the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS. Much excitement. But as with all things, the devil can often be in the detail. There's little details you need to look at. Now, fortunately, Evan Bloom, who is a senior fellow at the Polar Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholarship in Washington, D.C., has some knowledge about the detail here. And it's important for us for a variety of reasons, because it relates to Antarctica and to the South China Sea, both things in which we are interested. He's particularly qualified to comment on this because he led the U.S. Antarctic diplomacy move at the Department of State between 2006 and 2020. So he's just the man. Evan Bloom, welcome to Counterpoint. I love the article in ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. I thought it was just fantastic. Now, look, tell us about this UNCLOS. Give us a quick bit on that, because that's the headline for it. It's not the real story. So what's the general introduction about UNCLOS? What would you tell us?
Well, so for the last, well, more than 10 years, the countries of the UN have been working on a new treaty covering the high seas, and they reached agreement about a month ago for what's called an implementing agreement under the Law of the Sea Convention, and it covers marine protected areas, marine genetic resources, environmental impact assessments, and other issues. But it was quite a big negotiation and a lot of hard fighting among the different countries, balancing their economic and political interests. And they finally reached a deal that will help move the world towards achieving greater conservation of marine spaces on the high seas.
Right. Now, by high seas, we're generally talking about areas that, you know, one country can't protect because it's not their area. It's international waters, if you like. And so this is going to be a good thing, because resources over and above just fish will be protected.
So it is a good thing, but it's a big treaty. It's 54 pages long and with lots of detailed provisions that countries are going to have to look carefully at to understand what their obligations are going to be.
Mm. You know, I spent some time in politics, Evan, and I used to, I think, annoy my colleagues. I didn't do it to annoy them. When something passed through the cabinet, I'd sometimes say, well, that's not much of an achievement, is it? I mean, it was. It is an achievement to get something through the cabinet, to get a law that's going to change things. But there's a long way between that and right down the bottom where the implementation happens. And when you have a big document like this that's so detailed, it does mean that it'll be a while, doesn't it, before the countries involved have really got a grip on it. It's not just the negotiators at the conference. Now the public servants who have a job of implementing it, perhaps putting some national laws in place, have to understand it, and that's going to take time.
Well, not only that, but in order to bring it into force, 60 countries are going to have to ratify it. And that will take probably a period of years. before it actually comes into force. I'm sure there'll be meetings at the UN to try to work on how it's going to be implemented, but it isn't in force yet.
No. Okay. Now, there's some detail here where China was quite keen to see this go ahead, had some bits it wanted included or some, what would you call it, variations. What's the story there? Because that's what affects, well, it all affects us, but we have a particular interest in the South China Sea and Antarctic.
Sure. Well, I left these negotiations as the former head of the U.S. delegation up in New York a couple of years ago, and so it all kind of reached a head recently. And in the final hours of negotiation, it's often the case that countries will come in and make some final demands in order to say that they will sign on. And according to a number of people who were present at the negotiation, it seemed that the Chinese were rather insistent on some wording in several places in the treaty that seemed to protect their particular interests in the South China Sea. That is, in theory at least, preventing the treaty from covering areas on the high seas that are subject to some sort of sovereignty disputes. So China appears to have insisted on that. And interestingly enough, it not only will do something potentially in relation to the South China Sea, but will have implications for the Southern Ocean as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does that affect us vis-a-vis the Antarctic? As I understand it, Russia and China don't accept the claims of the, I think it's six countries, have over Antarctica, and we're one of those countries.
Right. So there are seven countries that claim territory in Antarctica. And the Australian claim, as you may know, covers 42% of the continent. So it's quite large. And Russia and the U.S. and many other countries do not recognize any of those claims. I think there are four countries that recognize the Australian claim. But it's not an issue just related to Australia. It has to do with whether certain marine spaces surrounding the continent of Antarctica are, quote-unquote, areas beyond national jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So from, I would take an Australian point of view, going north from the claimed territory is 200 miles of an exclusive economic zone that Australia would say it has national jurisdiction over that area. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But other countries would say, no, this is high seas. So the question would come up, would this new high seas treaty be applicable to these areas in Antarctica? And one of the reasons that's really important these days is that this organization called CAMELAR, the Commission for the Conservation of Antarctic Marine Living Resources, has been working for many years on trying to set up large-scale marine protected areas. In 2016, it succeeded in doing that with the Ross Sea Marine Protected Area, which is the largest MPA in the entire world. But after 2016, China and Russia have said, no, they don't want any more MPAs and have been basically blocking progress within CAMELAR. And so the question was, can this new high seas treaty allow for a way of getting around that blockage within CAMELAR? And that is one of the key issues I was trying to focus on in my article.
And that's the same aspect is relevant for the South China Sea.
So if the treaty is not applicable to areas under dispute, that applies to large areas of the Southern Ocean as well because of the seven claimants and the maritime zones that they say exist in relation to their territory. So basically under the law of the sea, the marine spaces follow from rights to land. So if you have territory, then that decides what sort of maritime rights you have. But if you don't have territory, then there are no maritime rights. So that's the kind of thing you get when you try to figure out what areas this new treaty might cover in Antarctica.
Mm. Now, let's focus on Antarctica. There's a, you describe it as a very vibrant biodiversity close to land and the ice shelves down there. So that's why this is particularly relevant.
Yes, that's right. So these large-scale MPAs, and there are three main proposals that are being worked within the CAMELAR context.
Yeah.
Those MPAs sort of hug the shore. So a lot of the key aspects of biodiversity that you want to protect are close to shore, and those are areas where there are a lot of these claims where different countries will have different views about whether they're high seas or not.
Okay, we've identified the problem. How can this be resolved? I mean, we don't want the consequences where the marine protected areas, especially in the Antarctic, are no longer protected. We don't want that. How can we adjust this? Is it a diplomatic solution? Is it going back to the UN? Where do we go from here?
So I think that further work is needed diplomatically. There's going to be a special meeting of the Camelot Commission next month in Chile, and that will be an opportunity for diplomats to work further on this. And there has to be further outreach to China. So in 2015, the Chinese changed their position and said that they would support the Ross Sea MPA. So we know that we can convince them. Now, the Russians came on board the next year. But now that we have the conflict in Ukraine, I think it's rather unlikely that the Russians will, at this point, make any sort of concession on the marine protected area issue. I guess I wouldn't have a lot of hope for Russia right now, but I would focus on China and see if they can be convinced.
But is it right that there are three MPA areas down in the Antarctic?
So there are two ones that exist now, one in the South Orkneys and one in the Ross Sea.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to create more of them as part of this global effort to conserve marine spaces.
But China's only agreed to one of them, is that correct?
All Camelot states have agreed to two of them, the South Orkneys and the Ross Sea. But the last time there was agreement was in 2016, and since then there's been no further progress.
Not handy. Okay, diplomatic news. That spells forever. I mean, look at trade negotiations with the World Trade Organization. I mean, how long do those rounds go on? I mean, they do get resolved, that's true. But is there anything else that can be done?
Well, the hope was, at least for some environmental campaigners, was that this new high seas treaty might be a way of getting this UN conference of the parties to look into the problems related to the Southern Ocean. But technically, that's going to be rather difficult. But I think what the new treaty does point in the direction of is the international community really does want marine conservation. And they want it in a lot of different places. And so that will have some effect on galvanizing support within CAMELAR. But CAMELAR, like the Antarctic Treaty System, operates on the basis of consensus. So you have to have every member state agreeing. And so far, Russia and China have not been willing to play ball.
Okay. Well, look, thanks for talking to us today. This is a very interesting topic for us in Australia, well, for the world generally, interested in protection of oceans, marine protection areas, but for us particularly with our proximity to Antarctica and obviously to the South China Sea. So we're very grateful for your time from Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're still working out how to protect our oceans, and we're still working out how to deal with our colonial past. From where I sit, it seems one of the trendy things to do these days is to bag colonialism, as if everything to do with it was bad, and in particular, to focus on the British. Now, I'm not an apologist for the British. I've got mostly Irish and German ancestry. You know, not my issue. I was born a Republican. But I do think people have got this right out of perspective, really badly, and they're getting away with it because no one's pulling them up. No one's saying, hey, you actually don't know your history. So let's talk to Nigel Bigger. He's a Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology and Director of the Ethics and Empire Project at the University of Oxford. And he's written a piece recently for Quillette magazine called A Mixture of Pride and Shame. It's a pretty good explanation, really, of how we might feel about colonial past. But he joins us now from London. Nigel Bigger, with all the focus that we see on British colonialism, they were sort of, in a sense, the Johnny-come-latelys to colonialism, weren't they?
Yes, Amanda, it's really important to put European and British colonialism in perspective, because doing empire was something human beings have been doing since the dawn of history until the modern period. Everyone was doing it in the Middle East, in North America, Africa. The Zulus did it, the Comanche did it, the Chinese did it. Indians were doing it before the Europeans got into the act in roughly the mid-1400s.
So the British were quite late to it. You know, I think the British, I'm not saying this just because you're British, I've often said this to people, I think they get a bad run. You know, so much of the commentary on colonialism focuses on the British. And, you know, when you talk about saving the Western world for freedom in World War II, you know, people are always talking about the Americans, not the POMs. So I'm a bit sympathetic, even though I have no real English blood, I'm a bit sympathetic to this. Now, look, can we turn to the example of how people can get things out of perspective? And that might be with Rhodes, with people saying, tear him down, and just believing what they read. What can you tell us about that tawdry little example, I think it was?
Yeah, well, what was interesting, Amanda, is I was in Oxford in 2015-16 when a bunch of students were baying for Rhodes' statue in our high street to be torn down. Rhodes was no saint. I don't regard him as a hero. He was a capitalist. He was, like many entrepreneurs, he didn't like constraints, and he cut corners, and he practices were sharp. But people were calling him South Africa's Hitler, which is complete nonsense. And that's one instance of the gross exaggeration about the sins of the British Empire that lots of people want to make nowadays, I think mainly for political reasons, because it's advantageous politically to criticise the British colonial endeavours.
And look, we don't need to go into the detail of the quote because it'll take a bit of time, but some pretty unattractive remarks were attributed to him. And when people did a good look at it all, they discovered that it was made up from three different elements, from three different sources, and one of which was completely made up and the other two were misleading. How do people get away with this, just drumming up stuff and marching out and saying, this is the story about Rose, and it's not the story at all? How do they get away with it? Is that because the rest of us are lazy, or the rest of academia is lazy, or are they afraid to speak up?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Amanda. I mean, they get away with it basically because very few people, certainly in Britain, very few people know anything about colonial history. That's the first thing. Secondly, in the case of most people, it's not in their interest professionally to challenge folk who are criticizing colonialism, because certainly in my country, colonialism is equated with slavery and racism, and who wants to be thought for a moment to be in support of either racism or slavery? So I think those are probably the two main reasons why what is being claimed is not scrutinized in the way that it ought to be, because often, in my experience over the last 5-6 years, whenever I turn around and scrutinize what the zealous anti-colonialist critics are saying, these emperors appear to have very few clothes on.
Now, the European empires hopping into colonialism after Africa and the Middle East, you say the Portuguese were, I think your term is, first off the mark, then the Spanish, then the Dutch, then the French, and then the English. So it's extraordinary that they've ended up, if you like, taking the blame for all of the bad things. And so it is with slavery. I mean, they did engage in slavery, but slavery didn't start in England, did it?
Yeah. On your first point about the Brits getting all the flack, that requires a bit of thinking about, because as we've agreed, I mean, everyone was doing empire all over the world with white skins, black skins, brown skins. And so why the focus on the British? My own view is this is not about the past, it's about the present. It's a way of assaulting the record of the West, because until 1939, thereabouts, Britain was the leader of European civilization. America then took over during the Second World War. So this is really about the present, not the past. But in terms of the record of the empire, you're right. Some British people, some, were involved in slave trading and slavery from about 1650 to the early 1800s. But then the British Empire abolished slavery within its territories and then spent the second half of its existence suppressing slavery all over the world, from Brazil, across the Atlantic, across Africa, India, to Malaysia. So people who utter the phrase colonialism and slavery as if those two things were identical, they're simply wrong, because the second half of the life of British colonialism was anti-slavery, not slavery.
And Britain paid a lot of money to get out of slavery, didn't it? Hasn't that only recently been paid off?
Yes, well, yes, I mean, some people have done the sums and they reckon that in the 50 years roughly from 1807 to 1857, the British spent as much suppressing slavery as some British had earned in profits from slavery in the previous 50 years. And that was just suppressing slavery across the Atlantic. And there are a couple of American scholars who published an article some years ago in which they said that the British suppression of slavery across the Atlantic alone was the foremost example of expensive moral action in modern history.
You wouldn't find that on the front page of a daily paper.
No, you wouldn't. We need to think about why it is that certain truths like that don't get spoken about. And that's one reason I started to write about this and I published my book in February, Colonialism, A Moral Reckoning, because I wanted to show people the whole truth about Britain's colonial experience. Yes, the bad bits, and there were bad bits, very bad bits, but there are also bits that were noble and admirable, not least the century and a half long commitment to abolish slavery all over the world.
Now, you mention that this constant barrage of attacks on colonialism, and in particular British colonialism, has a negative effect on people's image of their nation, image of their past, their pride, bringing together. And it can be quite a, not so much divisive as demoralising and weakening effect,
yes,
such that you don't have this cohesive, positive attitude about the past, even though you might recognise bad things. Now, is this happening by accident or, and I'm not one of those mad conspiracy people, I don't think I am, I might be mad, but I'm not a conspiracy person, but is this just an accident or are there players behind pushing this? Is this the way societies in general fall into decline because they just let people bag them without saying, hey, hold on, that's not me?
Yes, well, that's another good question, Amanda. I mean, why is it happening now is accidental in the sense that it wasn't until the infamous killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020, then the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. And because, as you Australians know, because we share the same language with the Americans and because of America's cultural dominance, what happens in America happens in Britain and Australia and Canada pretty promptly afterwards. So Black Lives Matter moved across the Atlantic, revived the activities of anti-racist movements, bodies in Britain. And the story quickly spread that Britain is systemically racist and this has all got to do with our colonial past. Therefore, we need to pull down statues, repudiate our colonial past, and that way we will purify ourselves of systemic racism, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, our prime minister doesn't have a white skin, and in the last Boris Johnson government, almost every secretary of state in command of major departments of state in Britain didn't have white skins. So I think the assumption that Britain is systemically racist is highly dubious, and certainly the claim that this is all to do with Britain's colonial past, which was simply a litany of racism and oppression, is historically insupportable.
Is it in part related to us becoming a me society, rather than having a me generation, we have a me society, a victim society? And in order to have a voice, you almost have to say, well, you know, I was abused when I was a child, or my father beat me up, or, you know, someone wronged me in a contractual event and I'm the victim. And you have to qualify your victimhood before you speak. And this is encouraging people from all walks of life to think of themselves as victims because of things that have happened in the past to people they don't even know, you know, generations before.
Yeah. I'll come to that in a moment, Amanda. Just one thing to add to the previous question. No, I don't think that Russia and China are behind the current denigration of Britain's colonial past, but I do think that what you call the demoralization serves the purposes of Britain is no longer, of course, the superpower that it was up until just after the First World War. But we remain, along with Australia and Canada, New Zealand and other Western European countries, we remain important pillars of the West at a time when the West is under threat, not least from China. So that this dispute over colonial history matters politically very much indeed. But in terms of what you say about victimhood, that's right. I mean, that's why, as I said, the controversy really is less about the past than it is about the present. It's about people deciding that it is politically expedient or expedient in terms of their careers to claim to be a victim, to represent the oppressed peoples of the past, because victimhood gets you attention. And very few people have the courage to call you out and to say, well, yes, 200 years ago, your ancestors may have been slaves. You know, you sit here in London, sometimes sitting in a professorial office in a university, and you claim to be descendant of slaves. and to feel their pain. I mean, it's absurd, frankly. I mean, my people were Scots and they belonged to a Presbyterian sect in the 1600s who were persecuted by government troops. They had to hold their religious meetings up in the hills. Some of them were involved in battles they lost. Do I feel their pain? Don't be absurd. I mean, that was 200 years ago. There are plenty of people with black skins, even descendants of slaves, choose not to identify themselves as a descendant of slaves because there are more important things they want to do with their lives. So we do choose our identities, and some people choose them for political advantage.
Nigel Biggie, thanks for giving us your time today.
Not at all. Lovely to talk to you, Amanda.
If you hear nothing but bagging of colonialism, no recognition of any of the good things that might have come from it, you might get irritated. Do you think it's a good thing to be irritated? Irritation? It actually irritates me, but maybe it's a good thing. Maybe, as described to me, unlike anger, irritation has neither glamour nor radicalism on its side. And so it might be the mood we need. To talk to us about this, we're going to be joined by Will Rees. He's a writer and editor and publisher at Peninsula Press. And he is working on a book, Hypochondria, which is going to come out, we hope, soon. And he joins us from London. Will Rees, thanks for coming on Counterpoint. What are the top two things that cause you to be irritated?
Well, that's a difficult question because I would say that I'm a deeply irritable person. So trying to keep it to just two things might be tricky.
Well, okay, rattle off a few. We don't mind.
Yeah, just allow me to, you know, spread out and to list. Yeah. I think for me, the scent of chewing always does it.
Noisy eaters, I hate them. Yep.
Noisy eaters, yeah. And then also tapping. You know, I often work in the library and somewhere in that room, there will be someone tap, tap, tapping away with their fingers or their foot. And it just drives me crazy.
You've pointed out in the article you've written that people who leave a telephone to ring, that drives me crackers. I don't mind running late, but I can't stand people who arrive early. But, you know, you mentioned impudence can be irritating, but you're quite right. Obsequiousness is even more so. Now, what do we learn from this irritation? What do you want to tell us? What do you want us to understand about irritation?
Well, I think that there's a kind of paradox at the heart of irritation. You know, on the one hand, virtually anything seems to be able to trigger our irritation. And yet, on the other hand, there's something kind of empty about irritation as well. It's an almost tautological feeling in the sense that, you know, when we're irate, we know our claims against the world, very overstated. They're massively exaggerated. You know, we know that the sound of someone's ringing phone can't really account for the level of discomfort that it's causing us. And I think that our knowledge of this is also deeply irritating. I think we tend to be irritated by ourselves when we're in a state of irritation. So I suppose then the thing which I would want to draw out is the way that irritation is seemingly about every little thing, just one damn thing after another, but also in a sense about nothing at all.
Yeah, well, you describe it this way. I think it's elegant language, actually, because irritability puts us at our least reflective when we're preoccupied with those diminutive miseries whose oversized effect we know would not stand up to criticism. That's exactly what you're saying. The phone call ringing too long, you know, you're not going to get away at the same time. Well, I got stinking mad because the phone was ringing. I mean, you sound crazy. But irritation does that to you, and it can be ridiculous in itself, can't it? Irritation.
Yeah, and I think this is what I mean by the way that when we're irate, one of the things that we're irritated with tends to be ourselves. You know, a lot of people have compared irritation to anger. Anger tends to be very confident of itself. When we're angry, we tend to think that we're justified in being angry. I think that on some level, when we're irritated, we know that the feeling is a bit ridiculous. And so I suggest
it's not good enough to be angry about. There's not substance enough there. Yeah.
There's not enough.
You describe it as hovering at anger's threshold. I can't wait to read your book. You're fabulous with language. Hovering at anger's threshold is a wonderful turn of phrase. And as you say, we communicate all this by huffing and sighing and rolling our eyes and doing all this sort of stuff, but we never do much more than that, do we?
No. I think that, you know, with irritation, there isn't this kind of repertoire of emotional responses to draw on. You know, like you say, when we're angry, we shout, we hit the table. Perhaps we take out the knife, but hopefully we don't. But in any case, we've got a whole range of responses to draw on. With irritation, it's not really quite clear what one can do with one's irritation. You know, with irritation, we're just kind of left to ourselves. We're left with this kind of mean little feeling.
In the relationship of irritation to anger, some have described irritation as anger's meaner little sibling, the rotten little, you know, junior brother that's annoying. Do you think that's a fair way to describe it?
I think that in some ways it is, yeah. With anger, there's a sense that it's often directed toward injustices. So anger is typically a justified emotion. It has a kind of political quality to it as well. Whereas irritation, it seems to kind of be directed towards what Aristotle calls all of the wrong things. So whereas anger is directed toward perceived injustices, irritation is misdirected. It's kind of trigger happy, you could say. And yet the claim that I want to make in the piece as a whole is that we could think about irritation in other ways as well. And insofar as we do that, then the claim to it being anger's meaner little sibling might not be such a fair description.
Some of the ways people suggest you deal with irritation, you've pointed out one, you know, breathe, count to 10, relax. You say themselves are very irritating. It can be irritating when you're irritated by something and someone comes up with a ridiculous idea about how to fix it. You can be frustrated with people who do that. And that leads me to the question, irritation is different from frustration, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I think that irritation and frustration are often seen as very similar. But the big difference between them is that frustration sits in a much closer relationship with satisfaction. To be frustrated is to have a sense of what it is that you want and just simply not to have it or not to have it yet. So with frustration, it's very clear what's going to get rid of the feeling, and that is some hoped for satisfaction. So frustration, I think, has a much closer relationship than with pleasure, whereas irritation, it's not clear what's going to cancel out irritation in the same way as it is with frustration.
Now, irritation can be both mental and physical, can't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. You know, if we take a look at any dictionary, we'll find that right from the early modern period, when the word was absorbed from Latin, irritation is always referred both to a kind of mental and also a physical sense of discomfort. And in this physical sense of irritation, we're irritated by the things that tickle and scratch and rub and abrade. But when we think about the kind of language around irritation, we often find that this physical and this mental sense of irritation, they're kind of strangely commingled. You know, we are irritated mentally and physically by the things that abrade or chafe or aggravate us.
One of the things that I think comes out really well in your discussion is you might say to yourself, well, I don't want to be irritated. You know, I'd rather have a life where I didn't have irritations. But you had a friend who informed me about a terrible conversation he'd overheard at a bar the night before. And he ignored you when you asked him whether he moved or not. And he obviously stayed there to listen to the whole thing. Do you conclude from that that we like irritation because it lets us be annoyed and lets us vent a little to ourselves without actually getting angry?
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I think there is a kind of furtive relationship with pleasure when it comes to irritation. When I started to write about irritation and told friends about this, their response was so often to tell me about their irritating experiences. And as I point out in the piece, that itself became quite irritating for me. And one thing I noticed was that a person's ability to remember every detail of a conversation is never better than when they're describing a conversation that they claim to wish to have never heard in the first place. And I think this tells us something interesting about irritation. If we imagine overhearing a very irritating conversation, two very obvious responses might be to tune out or to move. But another one, just as common, I think, is to lean closer. So there's something quite compulsive, I think, then, about irritation. And like you say, it gives us an experience of something like anger, but in a kind of harmless way. You know, we love how hateful it allows us to feel. And then the other point I would make about its relationship to pleasure is that irritation allows us to complain. And I think we just love to complain. We love to list all of the things that really get on our nerves. And I think that's what irritation makes possible for us.
Well, people say that if I call someone irritable, I might say, well, because they get grumpy about things they shouldn't get grumpy about, and they stay grumpy for too long. So it's really about too much and too long for too little. We can be quite dismissive of irritation in that sense, but we all use it. We're dismissive of others who are irritable, but we quite like it ourselves. Do you think it is a form of deficiency, a weakness in ourselves?
I think we do tend to dismiss it in ourselves as well. I think that, you know, for as long as we have to endure our irritation, it colonizes our imaginations. It's the most important thing to us in so long as we're experiencing it. But after the irritation has finished, we're very quick to dismiss it. You know, we tell ourselves it was nothing, and then we think no more about it. And I think for me, this is the mistake. I think if there's something which I want to achieve with this piece, it's asking us that we listen a bit more closely, that we pay a bit more attention to our irritation.
And what it tells us about ourselves, do you think?
I think that's right, yeah. I mean, I would draw here on Sigmund Freud's famous discussion of what he calls evenly suspended attention. So just very briefly, evenly suspended attention is a therapeutic practice. It's a recommendation that he made to would-be psychoanalysts. And he says that when one is listening to a patient, one should never select from the material that they present, which is to say that you should never listen more closely to what you consider to be important. He says that when you do that, when you select from the material in front of you, you risk only finding out what you already know. So evenly suspended attention then is something like a suspension of the claim to know the difference between what's trivial and what's important. Now, Freud is speaking to would-be psychoanalysts. This is a clinical recommendation. And yet I think that it could be applied much more broadly. So when we suspend our attention evenly, what's opened up is the possibility of learning things that we don't already know. So what's opened up are the possibilities of surprise and discovery. And this, I think, is what listening to our irritation might do. I think listening to our irritation means accepting that we don't always know why we feel, how we feel. And if we're willing to listen to this and to explore this, then yes, I think that it might teach us to tell new stories about ourselves and about the world. We might become surprising to ourselves.
Well, I have to say, Will Rees, this has been a fascinating discussion. What a fabulous topic to pick. Thanks so much for joining us on Counterpoint.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
Here's a rant. You know, we're mostly nice people. We're fair, we're decent, we pay our taxes. But, you know, is that enough for you to be a good person? Is society and the community that you live in something that others create and you just enjoy? Your kids go to the local pool, for example. Do you volunteer as a guard or do some of the record keeping? You play tennis. Do you volunteer to do rosters or anything, something? If everything we ever used was provided only through the government, frankly, we'd be cactus. Civil society is just us doing different things together, making contributions, some more important than others, but all of them weaving a web that makes society. You know, I don't need to tell you this. Government does not create society. You and I do. So I think it's worth each of us reflecting on what we contribute to making that society, or whether we are the ones who sit back and suck it up. I'll tell you who does contribute, an 80-year-old who climbs mountains to help bogong moths and pygmy possums. No doubt you've heard of the Kosciuszko National Park and maybe the Bogong moths, but what about the little nocturnal possums? We've got a great story coming up that does involve the Bogong moths. I do remember Graham Richardson saying when they invaded the new Parliament House, let the Bogongs be gone. It's the most Shakespearean thing he's ever said. But let's talk to someone who knows a lot about this, Kate Evans. She's a freelance journalist who lives in rural New Zealand. We've spoken to her before. She has lived in Australia. She writes for the New Zealand Geographic for Scientific American. And she's written a piece explaining about the relationship between the Bogong moths and the beautiful little weeny, weeny possums. Kate Evans, welcome back to Counterpoint. Kate, when were you last in Kosciuszko National Park?
I actually came up in the spring in November. Linda Broom, who is a scientist that studies the mountain pygmy possum, invited me to come on her annual trip where she goes up there with a bunch of volunteers and they monitor the populations of the possums. They stay at Charlotte's Pass and they actually stay in a lodge called Pygmy Possum Lodge, which is just perfect. And they go out every morning and check their traps that they'd laid the night before and then they see if there are any mountain pygmy possums inside. And so I went up with her for 3 nights, I think, in November, just to watch them work. And to
it must be a bit of a treat, you know. Up and down Mount Blue Cow, which I'm told is about 6,500 feet high.
Yeah, it was hard to keep up with her, that's for sure.
Leading other volunteers and doing all this work. I mean, good on her. What did you learn about these dear little possums? I mean, people thought they were extinct, didn't they? And then there was this wow moment. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is one of the aspects of the story that I love when I first heard about them. Like, we thought they were extinct until the 1960s. And then some people caught some stealing bacon from one of the ski lodges at Mount Hotham. They thought they were mice or rats. But when they caught one, they realised that they weren't. And they were basically this living fossil that was only known from bones. Someone had found them in a cave in the 19th century and they'd given them this Latin name which meant small rock mouse. And then they found them living in boulder fields up in the Snowy Mountains around Mount Kosciuszko.
Now, when we say small, these are only about, you know, 34 grams, just over an ounce, aren't they? You could fit how many in the palm of your hand? Three or four?
Yeah, maybe a couple, depends on how big your hand is. Yeah, they double their weight over the summer. So they spend their entire summer stuffing themselves with Bogong moths, getting fat enough to hibernate through the winter. So the one that we caught was 34 grams in the spring, but apparently can get to double that by their autumn. They're like a little butterball with legs is how Linda described them to when we first spoke.
They'd probably be quite cute. But that's unusual for marsupials. Do you think they're the only one or one of very few that hibernate?
Yeah, I think they are one of the few marsupials. And technically it's called torpor. So as I understand it, the difference is that in torpor, they sort of wake up every couple of weeks and maybe have a drink of water and just check everything's okay, and then they go back into torpor. But that basically lasts for about 7 months, right through the winter. And then when the snow starts to melt and they sense that it's getting warmer, then they wake up.
Mm. Right. Well, they get ready for the coming summer when they raise their young and double their body weight so they can go back and do it again. What do they feast on? What's the key thing? It's these damn Bogong moths, isn't it?
Yeah, they do eat a whole bunch of different things, including seeds and the fruits of the mountain plum pine and insects and things like that. But the Bogong moths are a really important source of nutrition for them, and especially the ones that live highest up the mountains where there's not much other stuff, Bogong moths are totally crucial. So the Bogong moths come to hibernate for the summer. It's called estivation when they hide from the summer heat. And they come into the same rocky crevices that the possums are just waking up in. So breakfast arrives right on their doorstep. It's perfect.
How convenient. Or it should be. They've taken a bit of a whack, the Bogong moths, haven't they, with droughts and floods. Their numbers fell very, very dramatically.
There should be billions of them.
They're on the up again, aren't they?
Yeah. So there used to be about 4 billion of them that would migrate to the mountains each year. That number dropped by 99.5% in the 3 years of the drought, the recent drought. That was mainly due to drought on the Western Plains where they breed, which is about 1,000 kilometres away from the mountains. So they breed out on the plains and then they fly all the way to the Snowy Mountains for summer. And I'll tell you a bit more about how they navigate in a minute. And so consecutive droughts out there really took a huge hit for that population. They estimate about 20 million made it back at the worst parts of the drought. I just checked today with Peter Cayley from the CSIRO, who's been monitoring their populations on Mount Gingera near Canberra. And he confirmed that this summer they're back to about the numbers of half of what they were before the drought. So it's not as dire as it was. They are making a recovery, or at least starting to.
Oh, that's good.
But it's a reminder of how vulnerable they can be to extreme.
I have very clear memories of the Bogong moths. I was one of the parliamentarians that served in both the old parliament house, as they call it, and the new one. And in the new one, man was very clever with a beautiful architecture that suited the look of a building, didn't suit necessarily the people who worked in it. I forgot about the air conditioning vents and the massive lights on at night. And it distracted the Bogongs from their normal flight, and lots of them would invade Parliament House. It would smell like some sort of weird barbecue because they'd go and try and hide on the lights inside. You could smell them in the Senate chamber, and that's when Graham Richardson, famous senator, said, "Oh, let the Bogongs be gone."
Skellery too, and I remember them landing in my tea.
Oh, yuck. And the magpies outside of Parliament House, I mean, the drivers of the comm cars literally would go more slowly going around the square because the Maggies could hardly take off. They got so fat on these moths. It was just unbelievable.
As I hear, that's just not happening anymore.
No, it didn't happen in later years. That was because I think they smartened up and put some, you know, windowsill wire over the air conditioning vents and they found it harder to get
simple
in.
Simple solution, yeah.
Yeah, they defeated the architects in the first time. Let's get on to this navigation thing. There's been some tests or research done, and it is fascinating. Tell us about
that. It's amazing. So I talked to this guy called Eric Warrant, who's an Australian, but he's based at the University of Sweden. He's an entomologist, and he said to me that this is just literally the most amazing species of insect that he's ever heard of. And the only thing that they compare to in terms of their navigational abilities is the monarch butterfly going from Mexico to Canada over four generations. The Bogong moths do it in just one generation. And they're born on the Western Plains. They've never been to the Snowy Mountains in their lives. They wake up, you know, they emerge from caterpillars as a moth, and they somehow find their way to the mountains. And so Eric Warrant and his students have done a bunch of experiments involving, like, camping on top of a mountain, sticking little electrodes onto the moth's backs and trying to isolate different senses to figure out what it was that they were using and how they were actually finding their way. And so they think it's kind of two things. They're using their magnetic sense, which is something that a number of animals have, where they can sense the Earth's magnetic field. But then they're also using their visual sense, like the way that we would consult a compass and then go, oh, yeah, that tree over there.
This is the bit that I think is really fascinating.
It's amazing. And yet they couldn't figure out what it was that they were using as a cue in order to point the way. And basically they built this lab at Anonymity with a roof that wasn't made of corrugated iron because it needed to block out any metal signals, and then put the moths inside. And they used a star map where they, like, projected the Milky Way and the southern sky inside so that the moths could see the constellations. They discovered that the moths were using the lights of the Milky Way in order to guide their way to the mountains. And if they flipped it, they got confused. And if they used a random pattern of just dots, they got confused. If they flipped it, they would follow the way that the stars told them to go, not the way that they should actually go. So, they're both using their magnetic sense and they're consulting the stars.
That is extraordinary, isn't it? That is not just the magnetic sense.
And then it goes back again at the end of the summer.
How long do they live?
Just that 1 year, I think.
Oh, dear. Poor
I think
friends.
They go back and breed and then die, and then the caterpillars of the next generation make the journey the next year.
Okay. So this tells us a fair bit, doesn't it, that you can look at something as simple as a moth, as people would around the house, and think, oh, damn moth, you know, might eat, I don't know, the curtains or something.
Right.
But it's an integral part of these dear little, weeny little possum, mouse-like possums. Surviving. I mean, it all hangs together, doesn't it? Every little bit.
And not just the possums, I should say, like all through the Snowy Mountains, you'll see little ravens, these black birds, and it's really the soundtrack up there. You just hear them cawing, and they also totally rely on the Bogong moths and are kind of competing with the possums to snap them up. You see them sitting around on the rocks waiting.
Now, there's one really lovely part of it. Tell us about the biscuits.
Yeah, so this whole story, you know, is a relationship between these two species and their environment. And another factor is the bushfires. And so in 2020, the boulder fields where some possums live in Cabramurra burned. And Linda went up there pretty much straight after because she was worried that they wouldn't survive long without anything to drink. She was pretty sure they would have survived the fires because they could get right down under the boulders. but yeah, she wanted to get water to them. And luckily, Zoos Victoria had just developed these things that they call bogong bikkies, which mimic the nutritional qualities of bogong moss. They used, it's very gourmet. It's like macadamia nuts, coconut oil, mealworms, which maybe not so delicious, but a bunch of things that, to replace the bogong moss in their diet. They did that because of the drought and because the bogong moth populations were so low. But in New South Wales, they were able to use the bikkies to keep the possums alive in the 2 years after the bushfires. So every week, I think Parks New South Wales would go out there and replenish the feeders that they had and put the bikkies in there, and the possums would eat them. Because after the bushfires, there was just so little vegetation, so few insects, there was nothing else for them to eat there. And it worked really well. Linda Broom and Hayley Bates from UNSW went back in November, or maybe it was October, just before I met them, and trapped in those boulder fields, and there were heaps of possums. So they survived. They survived after the bushfires, and the bogong bikkies kept them alive. So, yeah, it's good to know that in emergency situations we do have some tools that we can use, but ideally we wouldn't have to.
Yeah. So where do we go from here?
The possums, yeah. I mean, there are so many threats in the Snowy Mountains. By the end of the century, there may not be that much snow left there for them. Without snow, they're vulnerable to cats. It's harder for them to hibernate. There's a whole lot of problems. So there are some paleontologists and ecologists that are looking to the possum's evolutionary history to see if they can get them to adapt to life in the lowland. So there's a program in Lithgow, which is at about 1,000 metres, so a bit lower than where any of the possums are found currently. And they've got a sanctuary there where they've put some possums in cages, and they're trying to see if they can adapt to living at lower elevations, to not hibernating, to not needing snow.
These guys have an interesting life, don't they? In the breeding facility where they're trying to get 16 separate pygmy possum enclosures loaded up with about 100 animals to see if they can survive in that different environment. They've got water trickling down the rock faces, and when they want to see if they're going to breed, they turn on the watering system, because apparently the moisture sets them all off, and they have what they call mad bonking sessions when they're doing the watering. Kate Evans, yeah. It's been a pleasure talking to you again today. Thanks for joining us again on Counterpoint.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Amanda.
That's the program for this week. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you join again next week. Don't forget, if you've got something to tell us, hop onto the ABC site, go to RN, and follow the prompts to Counterpoint. Until next week, this is Amanda Vanstone saying see you later.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.